From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. When Walking Dead actor Danai Gurira returned to the latest spinoff of the AMC series, she didn't just stay in front of the camera. She wrote a script.
It was great to do that. It taught me a lot about a lot of frustrations I'd had sometimes watching the Mothership show. Sometimes I was like, how was that used and not that? You know what I mean? Like, all the things that had kind of annoyed me when I'd watch the end product sometimes. Being behind the curtain, I was like, oh, that's how that happens.
Eric Deggans talked to Gurira and co-star Andrew Lincoln about reprising their characters in the latest Walking Dead spinoff, The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live. Gurira explains the lasting power of the franchise, and Lincoln talks about the steep drop-off in viewers of the original show once streaming and other distractions came on the scene. But first we banter. Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my colleague and banter, Matt Bellany. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So, ID Discovery has a new series about what went on with the spate of children's programs on Nickelodeon. These were extremely popular series like Drake and Josh and all that. And I'm sure you remember, as I do, Matt, when in the post-Harvey Weinstein revelations, when we were both at The Hollywood Reporter, and I'm still there, we got an onslaught of tips after that news broke to the point where we could almost not keep up with it. We had like a triage going. And people kept saying to us, what about Dan Schneider, who was the impresario of all these shows and had enormous power at Nickelodeon in that he created a lot of hits and therefore he was a golden boy as far as Nickelodeon getting the money is concerned. And we made, not you and I, but my colleague Scott Johnson at the time and I made, I don't know how many calls to try to figure out why people kept bringing this up. And now ID Discovery has turned up with a four-part documentary that's going to air on Max, and it kind of answers the question.
Yeah, and the big thing in this documentary is that Drake Bell, who was one of the stars of that era of shows, he is going public for the first time and identifying himself as one of the alleged victims, specifically of a man named Brian Peck, who actually went to prison for this behavior and was convicted, but we never knew who the plaintiff was in this situation. There's two things going on here. One is the specific behavior by Brian Peck that's alleged in this documentary, which is, you know, pretty horrific molestation allegations, sexual assault. And then there is the larger question of the toxicity on these shows beyond the specific allegations of this one incident. And that's where it all seems to point to Dan Schneider.
Yeah, Dan Schneider isn't accused of assaulting anyone, but he is definitely accused of creating a very toxic and I would say creepy atmosphere on this show. And one of the writers on one of his shows, a young woman, said that he had asked her to sort of emulate a particular sex act and said that at the time, you know, he was so powerful that she did it because otherwise you were going to be banned from that world of all these shows. I should mention too about Drake Bell, the star of Drake and Josh. Drake Bell has been accused of misconduct as well by a former girlfriend who accused him of verbal and physical abuse. And also he got involved with some kind of texting relationship or interaction with a 15-year-old girl. And he pleaded guilty. He was about 31 at the time. But, you know, I'm just looking at the reports from that era, and he's saying that, you know, he didn't really know, and this wasn't really, he implied strongly that he was pleading guilty just to make it go away. But, of course, an abuser has oftentimes been someone who was abused.
Yes, and now we have the very specific allegations by Drake Bell that are in this documentary where he speaks directly to the camera and describes the power that Dan Schneider had over these sets where people said that they didn't have a choice or they didn't feel like they had a choice. Nickelodeon, for its part, has said that, you know, we commend and support the strength required to come forward. They are backing Drake Bell, of course, but obviously this went on for a long time and nobody did anything.
Yeah, he made what I believe is one of the most tired comments, according to this young writer that I mentioned before. She said he challenged us to name a funny female writer. And this notion, women aren't funny, is one of the most ludicrous and tired. But here is this guy telling this to a room full of writers, including a couple of young women who, I'll note, had to split the salary so that they could get hired. So the kind of power that this guy had, the ability to consistently come up with hits, makes you very, very powerful in Hollywood. And then you're the golden boy and you can't speak out because he would banish you. So the stakes were high. And a lot of people would do a lot of things. I just wonder, to what degree is this still common in Hollywood? I mean, I still think that there are people who have a lot of power and scare people, and that we still don't have an effective mechanism, in my opinion, for dealing with this. This is a series that Investigation Discovery decided to make. Otherwise, we wouldn't be hearing this, you know? And that's happened over and over again, where the media is the blowing the whistle.
Yeah, exactly. And in his defense, Schneider did give a statement to the documentary that says, "Everything that happened on the shows I ran was carefully scrutinized by dozens of involved adults." Goes on to say that, you know, everything was, quote, fully approved by network executives on two coasts. That actually is probably true.
Yeah, and I feel like he's missing the point. Like,
yeah, I mean, that. I think he's deflecting and saying, if I did anything bad, you know, there's plenty of other people out there you could be blaming as well.
Yeah, don't hold me accountable for what I did. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, founding partner of Puck News. Back in 2010, when Frank Darabont's television adaptation of The Walking Dead debuted on AMC, tens of millions of viewers flocked to the dystopian hellscape overrun with zombies. The original series, or The Mothership, as it's called by fans and cast alike, ran for 11 seasons and spawned 6 spinoffs. It also launched the careers of actors Andrew Lincoln and Danai Gurira, who have returned for the latest iteration of the zombie saga, The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live. In the series premiere, viewers are brought up to speed as Andrew Lincoln's Rick Grimes, who had been abducted by the Civil Republic military in season 9 of The Walking Dead, writes a letter to his long-lost love, Michonne, played by Danai Gurira.
"I always thought I would wait to tell you everything when we were finally back together. That it'd just be a story on the porch after the sun went down, when we could barely see each other. But I have to tell you now, not everything. I can't face everything. This is most of it, but all of it, it was always about getting back to you."
Andrew Lincoln and Danai Gurira spoke to Eric Deggans about reanimating their characters in The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live.
"You know, when I had heard about this project, first we had heard, I think, that it was going to be a movie. And then in, I think, 2022, you guys went to Comic-Con and announced that it was going to be a TV show instead. So I was wondering if maybe you could talk a little bit about how it morphed, how this project changed from being a movie to being a TV show, and if you have any sense about why that happened or how that happened. Andrew, why don't you start, and then we'll go with Danai."
"Cool. Yeah, Eric. Well, I mean, I left the show. We spoke about this last night, actually. Scott Gimple and I had an exit strategy from season 4 or 5 that was going to be season 8. I was going to leave for, you know, personal sort of family reasons. It was a long shift to be apart from my wife and kids that was, you know, 8 months away from home. And that sort of stretched into season 9. And then there was always a question mark with Rick's exit. And then I think, not speaking for Danai, but it was a very similar situation that she left with a sort of ... to be continued. And Scott and I sort of were the architects of perhaps sort of the CRM of it all. There was a version of telling the story in film. And then we realized after COVID and a few delays that actually the better way to deliver this was a love story with, you know, the love of Rick's life. And it felt better and more satisfying to do it in 6 hours rather than 2. Over to you, Danai."
"Oh, and I just want to mention that Scott Gimple is the showrunner for the show, this show that you guys are on, but he's also the chief creative officer for the whole Walking Dead universe, just so people know who you're talking about. Okay, Danai?"
"Yeah, I mean, the ... of my leaving had always been connected to, even contractually, that I would join Andy in the version that would follow, whatever it was, to complete the narrative between them. And yeah, initially we were looking at being a feature, and then yeah, things shifted, and the whole like television aspect of a limited has a lot of interesting aspects to it that allow a certain type of exploration. So then we started to build it from that perspective. So that's when, you know, the three of us started to work together and design it into its current form.
So, Andrew, you left the mothership before Danai did. And I'm wondering, how did you want to change things so that when you came back, you wouldn't be facing necessarily the same issues you were facing when you decided to leave? And did you think it would take this long to get the project together and to actually create something that the fans could see?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, I did think, you know, one of the great reasons why I loved sort of returning to The Walking Dead was, you know, they kept pulling and pushing and stretching and bending Rick Grimes into different contortions of pain and misery and hope, you know, and
he's like Job.
It's like this yeah, guy. Man, yeah, it is. We spoke about that. Actually, I read a bit of the Testament around that because he's been tested in all areas, as have all the other characters. It was always the fascination that we were able to sort of interrogate them over such a long time. So I suppose the important thing was to sort of find a place that we hadn't explored, you know, psychologically for Rick, but also perhaps telling a bigger story of what the grown-ups have been doing while in the mothership we've been scrabbling around in the dirt trying to survive. And if we were able to marry those two quite ambitious ideas, then it seemed like a really interesting place to start this story. And then, yeah, I absolutely 100% agree with you. It took way too long to get this back on the road. But the greatest thing was, you know, working with old friends, dear friends, and people I admire intensely, like Danai, you know, and Scott. And also we had a whole other crew of people that we collected from the mothership to be part of this. And then had this wonderful East Coast crew and community, you know, to tell this story in New Jersey.
Oh, yeah, that's awesome. And I should warn you guys that I had a pretty good conversation with Scott Gimple a couple of weeks ago. So I got all the dirt. So I'm going to warn you. I got all the backstory. But Danai, I wanted to ask you in particular. Scott had told me that both you and Andrew had worked closely with him on developing the storylines and doing some of the writing and even in post-production and editing. You're a playwright anyway. I was wondering what that was like, being that deeply involved. And I was wondering, was this the first time that you had really gotten that deeply involved in the behind-the-scenes creation of Walking Dead scripts and the editing of the episodes?
Yes and no, because there were times where, you know, even on the mothership, we, you know, especially definitely towards the end of our time there. Andy only left, by the way, he left me exactly a year before I did. I think you left like June 2018, Andy, yeah. And I left July, right. Early July of 2019. So it was just like really right after him. But yeah, even those in those last moments of how to figure out the exit of the characters, I think we were quite involved with our respective characters. But yeah, of course, in terms of this level of involvement to actually, you know, crafted and definitely AMC had said that it's for you guys to do. And so we had definitely a freedom at the table to do that. And certainly that was a key reason for us to return, was to be able to know at this point, of course, how to craft this thing together. So yeah, I mean, I never planned or had any active interest, quite honestly, in writing an episode of Walking Dead. But I ended up writing an episode and, you know, it was very intense and it was a lot of work because Gimple was just like, just show run it. And I just sort of took over the whole navigation of it to screen and through post. And I mean, listen, I've been writing for TV for years, honestly. It's just I haven't, you know, just a lot of things have just been in development. So it wasn't new to me to deal with television creation. But in terms of working on it in the element of this realm that I've been in as an actor for 7.5 years, and now I'm stepping into the writing hat of it and sort of, you know, creating it myself in some ways, that was definitely new. And it was great to do that. It was also taught me a lot about a lot of frustrations I'd had sometimes watching the mothership show. Sometimes I was like, how was that used and not that, you know what I mean? Like all the things that had kind of annoyed me when I'd watch the end product sometimes, and being behind the curtain, I was like, oh, that's how that happens. I was like, no, guys, I was there. I know we have this other cut. Can we just put that in, please? You know, so it was interesting to actually like navigate the specificity of what things are used and why things are dropped. I was also able to navigate like the notes from the network personally versus being like very clear about why I disagree with something and I don't plan to do what they're asking. And that allowed me to realize, oh, sometimes maybe they got away with a note like this and that affected the thing I saw in a way that I was like, why did that happen? Not that. And I think what I love about the fact that I've been on the show so long was that I was at this point, you know, you sort of have, you know, enough deposits in the bank to start making withdrawals when you start saying, no, we want to do it this way, not that way. And that was kind of a circle to take with being a part of this franchise.
That's awesome. And I'm wondering in particular what you found that was really different from writing a play as opposed to writing for television, what you might have learned in getting so deeply involved. And is there something that the fans might see in the episode that you wrote or in other episodes that you came up with that you're particularly proud of?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, sometimes I think TV could learn a lot from theater. The playwright has a lot of creative control. And I think, you know, but you have to find a lot of balance, of course, with something, I guess, because TV is so darn expensive. You know, there's a lot more, you know, involvement from folks. But I think when things are done well on screen, it's when creators are allowed to really pursue their vision. And that's, I think, really what happens most of the time in theater. Not all the time, but most of the time, it's about the playwright pursuing their vision. So I think I sort of brought, Gimple called me stubborn last night. I think that in a good way, I think that that helps me a little because I know how to collaborate, definitely. And I know how to take notes. And I love it. I actually love a good note, but it has to stay in line with my vision. If the note stays in line with my vision, I'm very happy. If it doesn't, and it feels like it's egregious to the vision, then I have to go into a conversation to really explain why that does not work respectfully and really explain why. So yeah, I think that the biggest thing is there's the creative engine has a little bit more freedom in theater. So you have to really figure out how to navigate things in a way where you keep the vision uncompromised when you're dealing with television.
Coming up after the break, Andrew Lincoln talks about his initial grumpy reaction to AMC announcing the first Walking Dead spinoff while his show was still airing. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. In the peak years of The Walking Dead, tens of millions of viewers tuned in weekly to watch The Zombie Wars. The series ran for 12 years, but both Andrew Lincoln, who played series lead Rick Grimes, and Danai Gurira, who starred as his character's sweetheart, Michonne, left the show in its waning years. Now both Lincoln and Gurira have returned to reprise their roles in the new AMC spinoff, The Walking Dead, The Ones Who Live. AMC says the series premiere was the most watched episode of any show on the network streaming service. Andrew Lincoln and Danai Gurira spoke to Eric Deggans about returning to the world of the living dead.
At one time, The Walking Dead was the most watched show, or at least one of the most watched shows on cable television. And of course, when the show finally kind of wrapped up, it wasn't quite at that level. And I wonder if you guys have any theories about the arc of sort of popularity of the show, and if this project that you're doing right now is an opportunity to maybe reach some of those fans who were watching it when it was at its height and get them re-engaged with the show. Andy, what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a long story. I mean, and to be able to sustain, I mean, in our pomp, I think it was probably seasons 4 and 5 when we really were. It was extraordinary. I think people used to sort of read out, Denise used to read out the numbers on the Monday after the Sunday airing. And it was, and you know, and it was an astonishing time. But I think in answer to your question, I think the way people view television has changed. We used to get fan mail, or certainly I did, that was about families all watching it together.
Oh, yeah.
I've got kids now, and it's very difficult, even if you're in the same space, that they're not on a phone or a tablet and a phone or gaming. It's just the world and the way people view things has changed. You know, and I think it's very difficult to make noise in such a competitive marketplace. And there is so much content out there. It's very difficult to sort of get seen and hold your hand up. You know, I wanted to do this because, as Danai's already expressed, you know, I wanted to complete a story that we left unfinished, not only from my sense of obsessive completionist, but also because there were so many fans kept stopping me going, where have you gone? Could you please finish it? I'm not in the business of gauging numbers and, you know, anticipating sort of figures and things. I just want to tell the best story I possibly can, you know, and we gave it our best shot to do that, I think.
Yeah, I think the nature of television has changed so much over the years that those numbers from like 2014, 2015, I don't even know if they exist anywhere anymore. There's just such a shift that's happened, and even in terms of how numbers are calibrated. In the realm that we're in now and how TV has sort of been, it doesn't have the sort of numbers it used to have, and all types of restructuring of how TV even works has been happening. It's still actually a very successful franchise within that realm. What it had back in the early, the teens, was very extraordinary for any time period. But yeah, I mean, I think the thing that really works about the universe is that what the proposal of the narrative, which came about with the creation by, you know, Mr. Kirkman and then Frank Darabont, and how he launched the show, is really like, you know, you're so connected to human beings navigating this very unimaginable but somewhat imaginable terrain that you start to think it really is this test of what would your humanity become in this realm. And there's so many renditions to how would the world change in various ways. How would this type of institution react? How would this type of person react? Yesterday, Scott was saying, you know, the Shane approach versus the Rick approach. You know, there's so many ways that the world would shift and stories would occur if, God forbid, something like this would happen, that it sort of allows itself to keep telling stories that people gravitate towards. And I think really it's because the foundation of the show was so strong that even if it's now like more fragmented in terms of where the stories are and how there are various different narratives being told, the stories still arguably and objectively do well in terms of how things are calibrated in terms of success, quote unquote, these days.
And it's interesting that when AMC sort of announced its plan to sort of have all these spinoff series, when I first heard about it, I thought, well, you know, it seems like the show is not quite as popular. The Mothership was not quite as popular as it had been. You know, is that wise? But we've seen these offshoots sort of become, you know, the backbone of AMC's cable programming. I mean, I think, what are we at, 5 now? Are you guys surprised at all that these spinoffs have gone off and they've all formed their own little universes that continue to tell different corners of the Walking Dead universe?
Look, in all honesty, the first time that they announced that there was going to be a spinoff, I remember the council meeting that we had with the heads of AMC, and they sort of announced it with this like, surprise, this isn't this great news? And we were all really grumpy because we thought we're going to have to share narrative, because the moment you have a spinoff, story gets halved and they steal ideas that you can't have. So it becomes a competitive exercise. But then, as Danai's just so brilliantly expressed, is, you know, this is a landscape. It's a family drama set in hell. And there are so many ideas that you can move in so many different directions. And it's almost got a protean sense of itself that, you know, if you get a good idea and run with it in one direction about a community, then you've got a spin-off. And the lovely thing that I think that they've achieved at AMC is that they've got these beloved characters like Daryl, Carol, these wonderful actors. An audience, a hardcore audience, has spent a decade of their lives with, and you place them in a new environment with brilliant actors and good writers and a good team of creatives. And it doesn't surprise me at all that you get an audience locked into another spin-off. And I think that Scott Gimple being chief, what is it, head content officer, which sounds
Czar of the apocalypse. Let's just call him
yeah,
that.
Yes, yeah, Czar of the apocalypse. But it sounds like the most clinical sort of description. He's the sort of puppeteer behind all of this. And the most important thing, I think, about this whole story, when it began with the brilliance of Frank Darabont, Kirkman, and all of this amazing team, is it's a show for fans, made by fans. And I think that that has always been, you know, a recipe for success of the storytelling.
Yeah, man. I mean, yeah, that's really an interesting way to put it. I mean, yeah, I think it really is what I was saying, which is like they're the, what it's built on, it allows these stories to work and endure. And the wild popularity of it from the jump. Yeah, I can't even tell you how many times I've had families come to me, young, old, everything in between, 7 to 70, like literally 4 to 70, like literally love the show and watch it with family and friends and connect with their teenage sons over it and or with their daughters in college. That's the one thing they can bond on every week. Someone just told me that last week.
I have to confess that for a while, I felt like a terrible parent watching the show with my children. But now that I hear that other people are doing it, I don't feel quite, I don't feel quite so bad.
Oh yeah, they're like, she loves it. I'm like, what? Shouldn't she be asleep and like not? I was like, doesn't it scare you?
Nowadays, I think there's not much that scares kids on TV. So one question I did want to make sure that I asked you is that one of the knocks that I've heard on the Mothership show in particular was that it could feel like it was telling the same story over and over again. And it feels like when you look at some of the spinoffs, they solve that by getting key characters and moving them to different places, you know, having characters in New York or characters in France and you guys in New Jersey. I wonder, was that criticism ever in the back of your head as you were developing this? Did you want to make sure that you avoided something like that? What did you even think about that criticism?
I think I didn't sort of, I mean, I understand a criticism of the Mothership in as much as we look for a new home. We think it's a safe home and it's not a safe home. And then we have to find another home and deal with the, you know, mayhem ensues. But I suppose this felt very much part of the same continuum. This story begins with a guy waking up in hospital looking for his family. And I see it very much as sort of the final chapters of that story. But yes, we wanted to set it in a place that is a viable restart. So it's not about necessarily the threat of the zombies as much. It's about a civilization and an ideology and how to protect a legitimate 500-year restart for humanity. So it was a bit more like if we were doing Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, this is the Hamlet version. So we wanted to change it up and throw a new mythology and sort of shade in a bit. Because I love all of that. You know, if you dig in and you sort of lean in, even the credit sequence, if you freeze frame, the fans might want to freeze frame it. You'll get clues to the greater world and how it exists and what is happening very much in the background of this love story. So we wanted to tell a bigger story, I think. We had the ambitions to tell a bigger story and a different story. Yeah, 100%.
All right. Well, you know, I could talk to you guys about this all day, but I don't want to monopolize your time. I really appreciate you taking time to talk with us about this. And I'll just say, Andrew Lincoln and Danai Gurira, thank you so much for joining us on The Business.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
And that's The Business. Joshua Farnham produced and edited today's program with help this week from Hope Brush and Nick Lamponi, who mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW shows on kcrw.com. or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.